This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, and for the rest of the hour, a look at false memories. You know, if you talk to prosecutors, trial lawyers, policemen, they know how unreliable eyewitness accounts are. And even testimony in trials where people are asked to recall what they remember, the professionals will tell you that the memories are just not reliable. Scientists know this too. They have done hundreds of studies showing that our memories can be manipulated deliberately or unintentionally. We may believe wholeheartedly that we experienced something as children when in reality we simply saw it on a TV show. That certainly happened to me. You know, or that trip to the Grand Canyon, never happened. Game-winning home run in the Little League, actually a strikeout. The most famous example, and this is something I've heard about so many times, I'm sure it must be true, is of people leaving Disney World. And as they were leaving Disney World, they were asked, did they meet Bugs Bunny? And they said, yeah, sure, we could swear we met Bugs Bunny, even though Bugs is not a Disney character and probably was not in the theme park. But you know, this Bugs is just a benign false memory. There can be important issues. This is especially true in cases of repressed memories that are reiterated later in life, revealing forgotten childhood abuse and leading to criminal accusations. Some people believe that repressed memories are actually false memories created by misinformation. Now, researchers at Johns Hopkins University have been able to actually watch the brain in action as it creates a false memory. The researchers are not at a point of developing a lie detector for memories, but their studies have enhanced our knowledge of how the different parts of the brain form our memories. Craig Starks is an assistant professor of psychology at Johns Hopkins. He joins us by phone from Baltimore. Thanks for talking with us, Dr. Stark.
Well, thanks for you for having me on.
You're welcome. How is your study different from all those other studies that have come before it?
Well, our study, what we try to do here is to take a number of advanced neuroimaging techniques, so techniques in which we can really look at the activity that's going on inside the brain, and to try to apply those techniques to false memories in pretty everyday kinds of situations. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can create false memories in the lab pretty darn easily.
How do you do that?
So there's one of the tasks pioneered by some folks, Roediger and McDermott, some colleagues of mine at WashU. It's a very, very powerful effect. You can do things like just have participants read a list of words, something like table, sit, leg, seat, couch, desk, sofa, stool, etc. And then after a little bit of a delay, you ask them, well, what was on that list? Now, people are pretty accurate on this kind of thing. They're not going to come up with something totally random like dog or tree. They might end up saying something like, oh, table, couch, sofa, chair, stool. And
They're in the ballpark on those things.
They're in the ballpark, and they all seem pretty reasonable. But the difficulty there is that the word chair wasn't actually on that list. People will swear up and down that, in fact, it was, and you'll have to, in fact, go and show them, no, this is the list of words that I read to you, and it wasn't there. Mm-hmm. And people have done some neuroimaging work trying to actually see what's going on in the brain in this kind of paradigm. So, for instance, Dan Schachter at Harvard has done some really elegant work to try to look at this, but the problem still is that it's still not a really natural kind of setting. It's not like an everyday kind of false memory. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we really wanted to do. We wanted to see how this actually can happen in a more normal kind of setting. So we took a different kind of approach to it, and we used a different task. This one's, it's called a misinformation paradigm that Elizabeth Loftus had developed. And it's pretty straightforward. You have participants watch some event. So it can be done, for instance, they see a slideshow that kind of depicts an event.
Well, let me just stop you. All this time, though, their brain is being imaged inside of what? Describe it for us.
It's an MRI scanner. So mm-hmm. It's the same kind of scanner if you'd fallen on the ski slope and banged up your knee that the doctor might put you inside of, except we're taking pictures of your brain, and we're taking pictures that are really sensitive, actually, to different amounts of activity, different amounts of neural processing that's going on in the different regions.
So you're watching the brain light up in different colors as things happen.
Pretty much, yeah.
All right, so tell us, so they're inside the machine and you're asking them to do what?
They're inside the machine and we just say, you know, we're going to show you a series of events here and we want you just to watch the events. You know, later on we're going to test your memory for it. Mm-hmm. And so they see, for example, you know, girls walking down a street, she's carrying her bags and her purse, a stranger bumps into her, she drops all of her stuff, stranger helps her pick it up. In so doing, we see the stranger actually steals her wallet and puts it in his jacket pocket. And, you know, picks everything up. She moves along. The story continues. She sees her friend, shows her friend that she just bought a copy of the South Park movie, and et cetera. A little while later, after you've gone through and you've seen, in our case, eight of these, you then get this thing again. We tell you we're just going to show you the same things over again, and for the most part, we have. Now, you can do it, you can have people read a text description, you can have people watch the same sort of pictures again, but what we've done now is we've actually just changed a couple of the details. The gist of it's still the same. He still steals her wallet, but he sticks it in his back pants pocket. And instead of, you know, she bought the South Park movie, it's the X-Files movie. And we're done with the scanning, and we send them home, and we bring them back into the lab outside of the scanning environment, and we say, all right, you know, we want to actually see what you remember from that first time that we showed it to you. So, for example, you know, when he bumped into her and stole the wallet, did he put it in his shirt pocket? Sorry, did he put it in his coat pocket there, or in his back pants pocket, or maybe in his breast pocket? Turns out that people will, they're fairly accurate on this, a little over half the time they end up getting the correct answer. Very, very rarely do they pick something that, you know, never happened at all. For instance, the breast pocket there. And about a third of the time, though, they adopt what we call this misinformation, this little bit that we changed. And amazingly, for example, even if you had people just read it as text, they will remember seeing a picture of it. They can call up an image in their mind of her holding out the X-Files movie, which they'd never actually seen, or of him actually putting the wallet there in his jacket pocket. And that's what they've actually retrieved as a picture, in when in fact that really wasn't actually what happened at all.
So you can watch their brain make this false memory out of something they read.
And exactly.
This could be something like if you're on a jury and you read something in a newspaper or something, or you're an eyewitness and you read an account, that's how you could get a false memory.
Exactly. You read an account, or even worse yet, you come up with your own account.
Uh-huh.
One of the big points in this is that what we see going on and what's leading to these false memories is actually just the automatic encoding of this information. You automatically store stuff away. You may not be trying to learn things, but it is actually always getting stored away. So, for example, if you try to remember that event, and you remember, oh, yeah, that's right, and what you actually get out of your memory is, oh, you know, somebody was running out of a liquor store, and you saw a gun, and you saw some money. Well, as you try to reconstruct this event from the little bits and pieces that you have, you fill in all sorts of missing details.
And
you fill in things.
Yeah, and you can see that happening in the brain, the filling in part?
So what we've been looking at here isn't actually so much the filling in part. We've been looking at, and that's something we are looking at now, but what we end up seeing is wherever this misinformation comes from, it could come from us, we could show you something that's wrong, or if you could come up with some little bit on your own that's wrong, the point is it then gets into your memory. And later on, when you try to actually pull this information back, you get bits and pieces from all of these different events, and your brain tries to tie all of these bits and pieces into one coherent story, regardless of the fact that some of them came from one source and some of them came from a different source.
And you really think that it's really something you remembered.
Exactly. You can be very, very confident that this is, in fact, something that you remembered.
And is it possible to see it being cemented in your brain as that actual fact?
Yeah, and that's actually the sort of main contribution of the study that we did. Since we were scanning them as they were watching these various slides, what we were able to see was that if you look at the activity during this first presentation and during the second presentation, if you take those two bits of information, we can almost predict whether you're going to have a true or a false memory. The basic idea was, and it's one structure that we know is related to this kind of memory. In normal memory, this is the sort of structure that's used. It's called the hippocampus. If there's more activity here in the hippocampus the first time through and less activity the second time through, you're going to have a good shot of remembering that original, accurate, true kind of event. If the reverse was true, if there was a lot of activity during this misinformation phase and there wasn't very much in that first original phase, what's going to happen is you're going to remember that little bit of misinformation. You're going to remember, in this case, the X-Files movie, and you're going to then tie it into an actual sort of coherent kind of story. You're going to tie it into that first presentation.
Hmm. When a false memory is created, is the true memory sort of overwritten, you know, like you would do in a data bank?
Right. That's a question that folks have been trying to answer for a really long time, really since this really came up. Obviously, that's one of the key ideas. And unfortunately, the jury still really is out on that, whether we're able to completely eliminate the original one, whether both of them still sort of exist in there and yet they're kind of competing.
Yeah.
What this study shows is that at least it certainly can happen, and it does happen that, well, in fact, the first time there, you really didn't have a very good strong memory of that first one. You actually may not have gotten a little bit about what movie it was or what pocket he put it in the first time, but you did get it the second time.
You know what I'd be interested in knowing is if under hypnosis you get different results.
Yeah, I mean, there have been a number of studies that have tried to actually see if during hypnosis you can actually pull out something, you know, whether there's something in there that's true. And even without hypnosis, you can often really poke and prod and try to pull people's memory apart on this and say, okay, what do you really know on it? And that was something that we actually did add into this experiment because the worry is, well, look, maybe they're even just guessing. How do you really know that these are false memories? And how do we really know maybe they do always know both of them? And so, well, we asked them. Once they'd gone through and they'd made all their decisions, oh, I think it was the X-Files movie and it was in his back pocket, we then went back and we said, okay, can you tell us a little bit something about these memories? So do you remember seeing it the first time? Do you remember just seeing it the second time? Do you remember seeing it both times? Are you just guessing? Or did you notice even some kind of conflict? Was there something different about the first and second time? What we found was that, well, very often we had things that we would still solidly call false memories. So they just had seen it the second time. That's the one they sort of picked, the X-Files movie here, and yet they said, you know, I saw that just the first time, or I saw that both times. Not really noticing that there actually was any kind of conflict, even though we really gave that to them as a choice.
Did they ever come back and say, oh, I made a mistake? You know, now that you remind me, you're right. I saw him put it in the
Occasionally we do actually get that sort of thing, and that's why this source test is very important to really then try to pull out, because they have as much time as they want to actually come up with that sort of decision. And it will still be the case that, well, look, memory is it's a random kind of process. It doesn't always work.
Right.
And so sometimes you try to retrieve and you can't, and you even know that you know that information, and yet it just doesn't get there. And later on it actually does come to you.
So talking with Craig Stark of Johns Hopkins University this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You know, with all of this data, and even with the anecdotal stuff, but with the scientific data, it's even more concrete. How can anyone at a trial, a smart lawyer, I would think, would be able to point to studies like this and say, you know, memories are so reliable. How can we, believe anything a witness says?
That is a very, very huge problem. I mean, one of the things that came out a lot of the early work on false memory was the idea that, well, look, depending on how we ask these questions when we're trying to actually interview a witness, we really can actually be changing their memories. One of the classic examples was if you ask somebody, you show somebody a little movie and you say, how fast was the car going when it hit versus how fast was the car going when it smashed into the other object, you get two different estimates of the speed. And then people's memory later on, of course, is going to be different for it as well. And so it's the kind of thing that has now actually gotten into the legal knowledge and into the police work to try to get it so that when they are interviewing eyewitnesses, that they're not, or they're trying as hard as they can to actually not influence their memories.
So what kind of practical use can you make out of the kinds of studies that you're doing?
Well, one of the things to keep in mind from this study of Ms. Okada's in mind is that our memories are fragile, and our memories are always open to distortion. One of the things we see also is that this distortion happens very naturally. Even if you don't try to change somebody's memory, over time, not only does it weaken, but it changes and distorts as well.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever you're actually trying to retrieve something here, and you're trying to be accurate about it, you really do have to keep in mind that, hey, wait a minute, actually, this seems though, I mean, it's a faint enough kind of memory that it seems that this may not actually be true. I may be grabbing this from a couple of different times.
And this also may have implications not for the legal profession, but also from the psychology profession. You know, when you're trying to talk about people's past, if you make the wrong kind of suggestion, could you be creating a false memory?
You could very much be creating a false memory. And that's really one of the things that comes out of this misinformation paradigm. Even just by having, going through and telling the same story over again, but, either intentionally or unintentionally changing some of the details, those details get adopted. And if those details sort of amplify the story and make it, more problematic, or that something else is going on there, you may decide, okay, hey, let's explore that a little bit more. And then, well, each time something new gets added, it gets put away in your memory, and often in such a way that you don't necessarily remember where that came from. So did I come up with this last time as I was free associating, or was this part of the original event? You may have absolutely no idea.
So was Descartes right? I mean, I am what I am, you know, I mean...
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, quite, yes.
Well, what is reality? Well, I mean, certainly where memories are concerned.
Well, I sort of have this idea, you know, everything in the world is either psychology or physics. You know, it's either how you think it is or how it really is that actually ends up mattering. And if you have two people witness the same event, I mean, we often also see that they end up with very different accounts of it. And those different accounts are based on their past experiences. Mm. Their past experiences are their memories. So as they're watching something happen, they're seeing it in a different way.
But your scanner doesn't have the power to distinguish the somebody lying from someone telling the truth about a memory.
Yeah, that's one thing that so far we haven't actually tried to. I mean, our participants are all really trying to tell the truth as they're doing this. We're not trying to actually make them lie, and that may actually lead to a very different kind of set of activities. And that is something that, you know, our group and others are starting to try to pursue to see if, well, maybe we could actually tell a little bit. And there are areas in the brain that do seem to light up when you're having some kind of error or some sort of sense of internal conflict. And so we do see those kinds of things, but it is going to be sort of definitely a long way off before we could have that kind of thing be legally admissible.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you very much for taking time to talk with us. And we'll have to watch what we say and think now.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. Greg Stark, an assistant professor of psychology at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore.